The Autobiography of Calvin Coolidge, narrated by Rashad Thomas. Chapter 1. Scenes of My Childhood. The town of Plymouth lies on the easterly slope of the Green Mountains, about 20 miles west of the Connecticut River, and somewhat south of the central part of Vermont. This part of the state is made up of a series of narrow valleys and high hills, some of which rank as mountains that must reach an elevation of at least 2,500 feet. Its westerly boundary is along the summit of the main range, to where it falls off into the watershed of Lake Champlain and the St. Lawrence River. At one point, a little rill comes down a mountain until it strikes a rock, where it divides, part running north into the Ottauquechee and part south into the Black River, both of which later turn easterly to reach the Connecticut. In its natural state, this territory was all covered with evergreen and hardwood trees. It had large deposits of limestone, occasionally mixed with marble, and some granite. There were sporadic outcroppings of iron ore, and the sands of some of the streams showed considerable traces of gold. The soil was hard and rocky, but when cultivated, supported a good growth of vegetation. During colonial times, this region lay in an unbroken wilderness, until the coming of the French and Indian War, when a military road was cut through under the direction of General Amherst, running from Charlestown, New Hampshire, to Fort Ticonderoga, New York. This line of march lay through the south part of the town, crossing the Black River at the head of the two beautiful lakes, and running over the hill towards the valley of the Otter Creek. When settlers began to come in around the time of the Revolution, the grandfather of my grandfather, Captain John Coolidge, located a farm near the height of land westward from the river along this military road, where he settled in about 1780. He had served in the Revolutionary Army, and may have learned of this region from some of his comrades who had known it in the old French wars, or who had passed over it in the campaign against Burgoyne, which culminated at Saratoga. He had 5 children, and acquired 5 farms, so that each of his descendants was provided with a homestead. His oldest son, Calvin, came into possession of the one which I now own, where it is said that Captain John spent his declining years. He lies buried beside his wife in the little neighborhood cemetery not far distant. The early settlers of Plymouth appear to have come mostly from Massachusetts, though some of them had stopped on the way in New Hampshire. They were English Puritan stock, and their choice of a habitation stamps them with a courageous pioneering spirit. Their first buildings were log houses, the remains of which were visible in some places in my early boyhood, though they had long since been given over to the sheltering of domestic animals. The town must have settled up with considerable rapidity, for as early as 1840 it had about 1,400 inhabitants, scattered about the valleys and on the sides of the hills, which the mountains divided into a considerable number of different neighborhoods, each with a well-developed local community spirit. As time went on, much land was cleared of forest, very substantial buildings of wood construction were erected, sawmills and grist mills were located along the streams, and the sale of lumber and lime, farm products, and domestic animals brought considerable money into the town, which was laid out for improvements or found its way into the country store. It was a hard but wholesome life, under which the people suffered many privations and enjoyed many advantages, without any clear realization of the existence of either one of them. They were a hardy, self-contained people. Most of them are gone now, and their old homesteads are reverting it to the wilderness. They went forth to conquer where the trees were thicker, the fields larger, and the problems more difficult. I have seen their descendants scattered all over the country, especially in the Middle West, and as far south as the Gulf of Mexico, and westward to the Pacific Slope. It was into this community that I was born on the 4th day of July, 1872. My parents then lived in a 5-room, story-and-a-half cottage attached to the post office and general store, of which my father was the proprietor. While they intended to name me for my father, they always called me Calvin, so the John became discarded. Our house was well shaded with maple trees and had a yard in front enclosed with a picket fence, in which grew a mountain ash, a plum tree, and the customary purple lilac bushes. In the summertime, my mother planted her flower bed there. Her parents, who were prosperous farmers, lived in the large house across the road, which had been built for a hotel, and still has the old hall in it, where public dances were held in former days, and a spacious corner on the front side known as the bar room, indicating what had been sold there before my grandfather Moore bought the premises. On an adjoining farm, about 65 rods distant, lived my grandfather and grandmother Coolidge. Within view were two more collections of farm buildings, three dwelling houses with their barns, a church, a schoolhouse, and a blacksmith shop. A little out of sight dwelt the local butter tub maker, and beyond him the shoemaker. This locality was known as the Notch, being situated at the head of a valley in an irregular bowl of hills. The scene was one of much natural beauty, of which I think the inhabitants had little realization, though they all love it because it was their home, and were always ready to contend that it surpassed all the surrounding communities and compared favorably with any other place on earth. My sister Abby was born in the same house in April 1875. We lived there until 1876, when the place was bought across the road, which had about 2 acres of land with a house and a number of barns and a blacksmith shop. About it were a considerable number of good apple trees. I think the price paid was $375. Almost at once, the principal barn was sold for $100 to be moved away. My father was a good trader. Some repairs were made on the inside, and black walnut furniture was bought in from Boston to furnish the parlor and sitting room. It was a plain, square-sided house with a long L, to which the horse barn was soon added. The outside has since been remodeled and the piazza built. A young woman was always employed to do the housework. Whatever was needed never failed to be provided. While in theory I was always urged to work and to save, in practice I was permitted to do my share of playing and wasting. My playthings often lay in the road to be run over, and my ball game often interfered with my filling the wood box. I have been taken out of bed to do penance for such derelictions. My father, John Calvin Coolidge, ran the country store. He was successful. The annual rent of the whole place was $40. I have heard him say that his merchandise bills were about $10,000 yearly. He had no other expenses. His profits were about $100 per month on the average. So he must have sold on a very close margin. He trusted nearly everybody, but lost a surprisingly small amount. Sometimes people he had not seen for years would return and pay him the whole bill. He went to Boston in the spring and fall to buy goods. He took the midnight train from Ludlow, where they did not have sleeping cars, arriving in the city early in the morning, which saved him his hotel bill. He was a good businessman, a very hard worker, and did not like to see things wasted. He kept the store about 13 years and sold it to my mother's brother, who became a prosperous merchant. In addition to his business ability, my father was very skillful with his hands. He worked with a carriage maker for a short time when he was young, and the best buggy he had for 20 years was one he made himself. He had a complete set of tools, ample to do all kinds of building and carpenter work. He knew how to lay bricks, and was an excellent stonemason. Following his sale of the store, about the time my grandfather died, besides running the farm, he opened the old blacksmith shop, which stood upon the place across the road to which we had moved. He hired a blacksmith at $1 per day, who was a large-framed, powerful man with a black beard, said to be sometimes quarrelsome. I have seen him unaided throw a refractory horse to the ground when it objected to being shod. But he was always kind to me, letting me fuss around the shop, leaving his own row to do 3 or 4 hills for me so that I could more easily keep up with the rest of the men in hoeing times, or favoring me in some way in the hayfield, as he helped on the farm in busy times. He always pitched the hay on the ox cart, and I raked after. If I was getting behind, he slowed up a little. He was a big-hearted man. I wish I could see that blacksmith again. The iron work for farm wagons and sled was fashioned and put on in the shop, oxen and horses brought there for shoeing, and metal parts of farm implements often repaired. My father seemed to like to work in the shop, but did not go there much except when a difficult piece of work was required, like welding a broken steel section rod of a mowing machine, which had to be done with great precision or it would break again. He kept tools for mending shoes and harnesses, and repairing water pipes and tinware. He knew how to perform all kinds of delicate operations on domestic animals. The lines he laid out were true and straight, and the curves regular. The work he did endured. If there was any physical requirement of country life which he could not perform, I do not know what it was. From watching him and assisting him, I gained an intimate knowledge of all this kind of work. It seems impossible that any man could adequately describe his mother. I cannot describe mine. On the side of her father, Hiram Dunlop Moore, she was Scotch with a mixture of Welsh and English. Her mother, Abigail Franklin Moore, was chiefly of the old New England stock. She bore the name of two empresses, Victoria Josephine. She was of a very light and fair complexion, with a rich growth of brown hair that had a glint of gold in it. Her hands and features were regular and finely modeled. The older people always told me how beautiful she was in her youth. She was practically an invalid ever after I could remember her, but used what strength she had in lavish care upon me and my sister, who was 3 years younger. There was a touch of mysticism and poetry in her nature, which made her love to gaze at the purple sunsets and watch the evening stars. Whatever was grand and beautiful in form and color attracted her. It seemed as though the rich green tints of the foliage and the blossoms of the flowers came for her in the springtime, and in the autumn it was for her that the mountainsides were struck with crimson and with gold. When she knew that her end was near, she called us children to her bedside, where we knelt down to receive her final parting blessing. In an hour she was gone. It was her 39th birthday. I was 12 years old. We laid her away in the blustering snows of March. The greatest grief that can come to a boy came to me. Life was never to seem the same again. 5 years and 41 years later, almost to a day, my sister and my father followed her. It always seemed to me that the boy I lost was her image. They all rest together on the sheltered hillside among 5 generations of the Coolidge family. My grandfather, Calvin Galusha Coolidge, died when I was 6 years old. He was a spare man, over 6 feet tall, of a nature which caused people to confide in him, and of a character which made him a constant choice for public office. His mother and her family showed a marked trace of Indian blood. I never saw her, but he took me one time to see her sister, his very aged aunt, whom we found sitting in the chimney corner smoking a clay pipe. This was so uncommon that I always remembered it. I thought tobacco was only for men, though I had seen old ladies outside our neighborhood buy snuff at the store. He was an expert horseman and loved to raise colts and puppies. He kept peacocks and other gay-colored fowl, and had a yard and garden filled with scarlet flowers, but he never cared to hunt or fish. He found great amusement in practical jokes, and could entice a man into a nest of bees, and make him think he went there of his own accord. He and my grandmother brought up as their own children the boy and girl of his only sister, whose parents died when they were less than 2 years old. He made them no charge, but managed their inheritance and turned it all over to them with the income, besides giving the boy $800 of his own money when he was 18 years old, the same as he did my father. He was fond of riding horseback, and taught me to ride standing up behind him. Some of the horses he bred and sold became famous. In his mind, the only real respectable way to get a living was from tilling the soil. He therefore did not exactly approve having his son go into trade. In order to tie me to the land, in his last sickness he executed a deed to me for life of 40 acres, called the Lime Kiln Lot. On the west part of his farm, with the remainder to my lineal descendants, thinking that as I could not sell it, and my creditors could not get it, it would be necessary for me to cultivate it. He also gave me a mare colt and a heifer calf, which came of stock that had belonged to his grandfather. 2 days after I was 2 months old, my father was elected to the state legislature. By a curious coincidence, when my son was the same age, I was elected to the same office in Massachusetts. He was re-elected twice, the term being 2 years, and while he was serving, my grandfather took my mother and me to visit him at Montpelier. I think I was 3 years and 4 months old, but I always remembered the experience. Grandfather carried me to the state house and sat me in the governor's chair, which did not impress me so much as the stuffed catamount that was in the Capitol Museum. That was the first of the great many journeys which I have since made to legislative halls. During his last illness, he would have me read to him the first chapter of the Gospel of John, which he had read to his grandfather. I could do very well until I came to the word comprehended, with which I always had difficulty. On taking the oath as president in 1925, I placed my hand on that book of the Bible in memory of my first reading it. So far as I know, neither he nor any other members of my family ever entertained any ambitions in my behalf. He evidently wished me to stay on the land. My own wish was to keep store, as my father had done. They all taught me to be faithful over a few things. If they had any idea that such a training might some day make me a ruler over many things, it was not disclosed to me. It was my father, in later years, who wished me to enter the law, but when I finally left home for that purpose, the parting was very hard for him to bear. The neighborhood around the Notch was made up of people of exemplary habits. Their speech was clean, and their lives were above reproach. They had no mortgages on their farms. If any debts were contracted, they were promptly paid. Credit was good, and there was money in the savings bank. The break of day saw them stirring. Their industry continued until twilight. They kept up no church organization, and as there was little regular preaching, the outward manifestation of religion through public profession had little opportunity. But they were without exception a people of faith and charity and of good works. They cherished the teachings of the Bible, and sought to live in accordance with its precepts. The conduct of the young people was modest and respectful. For most of the time during my boyhood, regular Sunday school classes were held in the church which my grandmother Coolidge superintended, until in her advanced years she was superseded by my father. She was a constant reader of the Bible and a devoted member of the church, who daily sought for divine guidance in prayer. I stayed with her at the farm much of the time, and she had much to do with shaping the thought of my early years. She had a benign influence over all who came in contact with her. The Puritan severity of her convictions was tempered by the sweetness of a womanly charity. There were none whom she ever knew that had not in some way benefited by her kindness. Her maiden name was Sarah Almeida Brewer. When she married my grandfather, she was 20, and he was 28 years old. She was accustomed to telling me that from his experience and observations, he had come to have great faith in good blood, and that he chose her for his wife not only because he loved her, but because her family, which he had seen for 3 generations, were people of ability and character. While he would have looked upon rank as only pretense, he looked upon merit with great respect. His judgment was vindicated by the fact that more of her kinfolks than he could have realized had been and were to become people of merited distinction. The prevailing dress in our neighborhood was that of the countryside. While my father wore a business suit with a white shirt, collar, and cuffs, which he always kept clean, the men generally had colored shirts and outer garments of brown or blue drilling. But they all had good clothes for any important occasions. I was clad in a gingham shirt with overalls in the summer, when I liked to go barefoot. In the winter, these were changed for heavy wool garments and thick cowhide boots, which lasted a year. My grandmother Coolidge spun woolen yarn, from which she knitted us stockings and mittens. I have seen her weave cloth, and when I was 10 years old, I had a frock which came from her loom. We had linen sheets and tablecloths and woolen bed blankets, which she had spun and woven in earlier days. I have some of them now. My grandfather Coolidge wore a blue woolen frock much of the time, which is a most convenient garment for that region. It is cut like a shirt, going on over the head, with flaps that reach to the knees. When I went to visit the old home in later years, I liked to wear the one he left, with some fine calfskin boots, about two sizes too large for me, which were made for him when he went to the Vermont legislature about 1858. When news pictures began to be taken of me there, I found that among the public this was generally supposed to be a makeup costume, which was not, so I have since been obliged to forego the comfort of wearing it. In public life, it is sometimes necessary, in order to appear really natural, to be actually artificial. Perhaps some glimpse of these pictures may have caused an English writer to refer to me as a Vermont backwoodsman. I wonder if he describes his king as a Scotchman when he sees him in kilts. To those of his country who remember that Burgoyne sent home a dispatch saying that the Green Mountains were the abode of the most warlike race on the continent, who hung like a thundercloud on his left, which was fully borne out by what they helped to do to him at Bennington and Saratoga, I presume the term of Vermont backwoodsman still carries the implication of reproach. But in this country it is an appellation which, from General Ethan Allen to Admiral George Dewey, has not been without some distinction. While the form of government under which the Plymouth people lived was that of a republic, it had a strong democratic trend. The smallest unit was then the school district. Early in my boyhood, the women were given a vote on school questions in both the district and town meetings. The district meeting was held in the evening at the schoolhouse each year. The officers were chosen, and the rate of the school tax was fixed by popular vote. The board and room of the teacher for two-week periods was then assigned to the lowest bidders. The rates ran from about 50 cents each week in the summer to as high as $1.25 in the winter. The town officers were chosen annually at the March meeting. Here again the rate of taxes was fixed by popular vote. The bonded debt was rather large, coming down, as I was told, from expenses during the war and the costs of reconstructing roads and bridges after the disastrous freshet of 1869. The more substantial farmers wanted to raise a large tax to reduce the debt. I noticed my father did not vote on this subject, and I inquired his reason. He said that while he could afford to pay a high rate, he did not wish to place so large a burden on those who were less able, and so was leaving them to make their own decision. In those days, there were about 250 qualified voters, not over 25 of which were Democrats, and the rest Republicans. They had their spirited contests in their elections, but not along party lines. One of the patriarchs of the town, who was a Democrat, served many years as moderator by unanimous choice. He was a man of sound common sense and an excellent presiding officer, but without much book learning. When he read that part of the call for the meeting, which recited that it was to act, quote, on the following questions, viz., quote, he always read it, quote, to act upon the following questions, viz.ly, quote, unquote. This caused him to be referred to at times by the irreverent as Old Viz.ly. I was accustomed to carry apples and popcorn balls to the town meetings to sell, mainly because my grandmother said my father had done so when he was a boy, and I was exceedingly anxious to grow up to be like him. On the even years in September came the Freeman's meeting. This was a state election, at which the town representative to the legislature was chosen. They also voted for county and state officers, and for a representative to the Congress, and on each fourth year for presidential electors. I attended all of these meetings until I left home, and followed them with interest for many of the succeeding years. Careful provision was made for the administration of justice through local authorities. Those charged with petty crimes and misdemeanors were brought before one of the five justices of the peace, who had power to try and sentence with or without calling a jury. He also had a like jurisdiction in civil matters of a small amount. The more important cases, criminal and civil, went to the county court, which sat in the neighboring town of Woodstock, in May and December. My father was nearly all his life constable or a deputy sheriff, and sometimes both, with power to serve civil and criminal process, so that he arrested those charged with crime and brought them before the justice for trial. Unless it would keep me out of school, he would take me with him when attending before the local justices, or when he went to the opening session of the county court. Before him, my grandfather had held the same positions, so that together they were the peace officers most of the time in our town for nearly 75 years. In addition to this, they often settled the estates of deceased persons and acted as guardians of minors. This business was transacted in the probate court, where I often went. My father was at times a justice of the peace and always had a commission as notary public. This enabled him to take the acknowledgment of deeds, which he knew how to draw, and administer oaths necessary to pension papers, which he filled out for old soldiers, usually without charge, or to take affidavits required on any other instruments. In my youth, he was also always engaged in the transaction of all kinds of town business, being constantly elected for that purpose. He was painstaking, precise, and very accurate, and had such wide experience that the lawyers of the region knew they could rely on him to serve papers in difficult cases and make returns that would be upheld by the courts. This work gave him such a broad knowledge of the practical side of the law that people of the neighborhood were constantly seeking his advice, to which I always listened with great interest. He always counseled them to resist injustice and avoid unfair dealings, but to keep their agreements, meet their obligations, and observe strict obedience to the law. By reason of what I saw and heard in my early life, I came to have a good working knowledge of the practical side of government. I understood that it consisted of restraints which the people had imposed upon themselves in order to promote the common welfare. As I went about with my father, when he collected taxes, I knew that when taxes were laid, someone had to work to earn the money to pay them. I saw that a public debt was a burden on all the people in the community, and while it was necessary to meet the needs of a disaster, it cost much in interest and ought to be retired as soon as possible. After the winter work of laying in a supply of wood had been done, the farm year began about the 1st of April, with the opening of the maple sugar season. This was the most interesting of all the farm operations to me. With the coming of the first warm days, we broke a road through the deep snow into the sugar lot, tapped the trees, set the buckets, and brought the sap to the sugar house, where in a heater and pans it was boiled down into syrup to be taken to the house for sugaring off. We made 800 to 2,000 pounds, according to the season. After that, the fences had to be repaired where they had been broken down by the snow, the cattle turned out to pasture, and the spring planting done. Then came sheep shearing time, which was followed by getting in the hay, harvesting and threshing of the grain, cutting and husking the corn, digging the potatoes, and picking the apples. Just before Thanksgiving, the poultry had to be dressed for market, and a little later the fattened hogs were butchered, and the meat salted down. Early in the winter, a beef creature was slaughtered. The work of the farm was done by the oxen, except running the mowing machine and horse rake. I early learned to drive oxen, and used to plow with them alone when I was 12 years old. Of course, there was the constant care of the domestic animals, the milking of the cows, and taking them to and from pasture, which was especially my responsibility. We had husking bees, apple-paring bees, and singing schools in the winter. There were parties for the young folks, and an occasional dramatic exhibition by local talent. Not far away, there were some public dances, which I was never permitted to attend. Sometime during the summer, we usually went to the circus, often rising by 3 o'clock so as to get there early. In the autumn, we visited the county fair. The holidays were all celebrated in some fashion. Of course, the 4th of July meant a great deal to me, because it was my birthday. The first one I can remember was when I was 4 years old. My father took me fishing in the meadow brook in the morning. I recall that I fell into the water, after which we had a heavy thunder shower, so that we both came home very wet. Usually there was a picnic celebration on that day. Thanksgiving was a feast day for family reunions at the home of the grandparents. Christmas was a sacrament observed with the exchange of gifts, when the stockings were hung and the spruce tree was lighted in the symbol of Christian faith and love. While there was plenty of hard work, there was no lack of pleasurable diversion. When the work was done for the day, it was customary to drop into the store to get the evening mail and exchange views on topics of interest. A few times I saw there Attorney General John G. Sargent with his father, who was a much respected man. A number of those who came had followed Sheridan, been with Meade at Gettysburg, and served under Grant, but they seldom volunteered any information about it. They were not talkative and took their military service in a matter-of-fact way, not as anything to brag about, but merely as something they did because it ought to be done. They drew no class distinctions except towards those who assumed superior airs. Those they held in contempt. They held strongly to the doctrine of equality. Whenever the hired man or the hired girl wanted to go anywhere, they were always understood to be entitled to my place in the wagon, in which case I remained at home. This gave me a very early training in democratic ideas and impressed upon me very forcibly the dignity and power, if not the superiority, of labor. It was all a fine atmosphere in which to raise a boy. As I look back on it, I constantly think how clean it was. There was little about it that was artificial. It was all close to nature and in accordance with the ways of nature. The streams ran clear. The roads, the woods, the fields, the people, all were clean. Even when I try to divest it of the halo which I know always surrounds the past, I am unable to create any other impression than that it was fresh and clean. We had some books, but not many. Mother liked poetry and reading some novels. Father had no taste for books, but always took and read a daily paper. My grandfather Moore read books and papers, so that he was a well-informed man. My grandmother Coolidge liked books, and besides a daily chapter in the Bible, read aloud to me The Rangers, or The Tory's Daughter, and The Green Mountain Boys, which were both stories of the early settlers of Vermont during the Revolutionary period. She also had two volumes entitled Washington and His Generals, and other biographies which I read myself at an early age with a great deal of interest. At home there were numerous law books. In this way I grew up with a working knowledge of the foundations of my state and nation, and a taste for history. My education began with a set of blocks which had on them the Roman numerals and the letters of the alphabet. It is not yet finished. As I played with them and asked my mother what they were, I came to know them all when I was 3 years old. I started to school when I was five. The little stone schoolhouse, which had unpainted benches and desks wide enough to seat two, was attended by about 25 scholars. Few, if any, of my teachers reached the standard now required by all public schools. They qualified by examination before the town superintendent. I first took this examination and passed it at the age of 13, and my sister Abby passed it and taught a term of school in a neighboring town when she was 12 years old. My teachers were young women from neighboring communities, except sometimes when a man was employed for the winter term. They were all intelligent, of good character, and interested in their work. I do not feel that the quality of their instruction was in any way inferior. The common school subjects were taught, with grammar and United States history, so that when I was 13 I had mastered them all and went to Black River Academy at Ludlow. That was one of the greatest events of my life. The packing and preparation for it required more time and attention than collecting my belongings in preparation for leaving the White House. I counted the hours until it was time to go. My whole outfit went easily into two small handbags, which lay on the straw in the back of the traverse sleigh beside the fatted calf that was starting to market. The winter snow lay on the ground. The weather was well below freezing, but in my eagerness these counted for nothing. I was going where I would be mostly my own master. I was casting off what I thought was the drudgery of farm life, symbolized by the cowhide boots and everyday clothing which I was leaving behind, not realizing what a relief it would be to return to them in future years. I had on my best clothes and wore shoes with rubbers because the village had sidewalks. I did not know that there were mental and moral atmospheres more monotonous and more contaminating than anything in the physical atmosphere of country life. No one could have made me believe that I should never be so innocent or so happy again. As we rounded the brow of the hill, the first rays of the morning sun streamed over our backs and lighted up the glistening snow ahead. I was perfectly certain that I was traveling out of the darkness into the light. We have much speculation over whether the city or the country is the better place to bring up boys. I am prejudiced in behalf of the country, but I should have to admit that much depends on the parents and the surrounding neighborhood. We felt the cold in winter and had many inconveniences, but we did not mind them because we supposed that they were the inevitable burdens of existence. It would be hard to imagine better surroundings for the development of a boy than those which I had. While a wider breadth of training and knowledge could have been presented to me, there was a daily contact with many new ideas, and the mind was given sufficient opportunity thoroughly to digest all that came to it. Country life does not always have breadth, but it has depth. It is neither artificial nor superficial, but it is kept close to the realities. While I can think of many pleasures we did not have, and many niceties of culture with which we were unfamiliar, yet if I had the power to order my life anew, I would not dare to change that period of it. If it did not afford me the best that there was, it abundantly provided the best that there was for me.